From RTE Radio, I'm Neil O'Sheridan. This is Playback Daily.
That, you know, it's that classic thing they sort of say, it's not the crime, it's the cover-up. And that is still playing out to this day.
It's gone so well, Claire, they're now considering having phone-free lunch days. So
is it fair to say that the whole concentration of the ad is down there, so to speak?
Well, it seems to be down there, yes.
Coming up on this tariff-free edition of Playback Daily, award-winning journalist Carol Cadwallader on investigating Facebook. Whatever will we talk about? One Cork restaurant hosts a phone-free night. And, ouch, one woman's unhappiness with an ad for shaving products. That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show that's down there with the best of them. Once more unto the breach, dear friends, once more. And on his monologue this morning, Oliver Callan started with a look at who's consuming news and the declining numbers that are worrying if you're in the news game.
Spotted this in The Guardian yesterday, which was a feature on newsrooms scrambling to retain audiences because there is a big switch off. I would say it is on fast forward at the moment, because even just glancing around online at the biggest read stories, and I check in on the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Fox and other places, it's all Trump, 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 Greenland, tariffs, Elon Musk's candidate losing in the Wisconsin court race. It's just all Trump administration adjacent, and it would wear you down, grind you down. And 39% of respondents in a big, big international survey said they selectively avoid news. So it's all about news avoidance. And The Guardian basically spoke to people who call themselves news junkies once upon a time, but they're now restricting the news intake because they say they suffer from disturbed sleep. They have a downturn in their mood all the way through the day. In the conversations they're having with people, it's all about doom and gloom and so on. The Daily Mirror's editor-in-chief in Britain says the biggest challenge right now that's keeping her awake at night, as Caroline Watterson's her name, is the under 35 audiences. And basically, they're not at all tuned to news, and certainly not legacy news brands. And she's saying if news companies figure out a way how to reach them, then it could be a big opportunity for those companies. But most importantly, inform people who are the next generation of voters. The proportion of people who say they selectively avoid the news to some degree is increasing each year, every year since 2017. That's even before that big scoop on Cambridge Analytica and so on. And this is a survey that happened on 17 countries by the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism, and it includes Ireland. Since 2017, the number of people switching and avoiding the news has increased by 10 percentage points. We don't really have a breakdown here in Ireland. We do know that when times of crises occur, and they seem to happen every half an hour, you get a huge spike in all news media organisations in Ireland. And there are still high levels, much higher levels of trust in news media in Ireland, the kind of traditional brands like ourselves here, compared to countries, particularly other English-speaking countries like Britain and America. But that's to do with the results of elections and so on, you'd imagine. Over the last decade, the number of people, they say, in this feature, getting any news online, whether through a news website or social media, has fallen across every single age group. It's not just the youngsters switching off. The news avoiders are broken down into three groups. The first is a group of former news consumers dialing back. The second are people who never engaged with news in the first place. And the third group is the young people who have not only not engaged, but they have no trust or losing trust in established news brands. Also, the social media algorithms and search engines are kind of tuning out the news. So even if you go into Google and you're looking up a news story, it's harder and harder to find articles from the usual news sites that you probably have subscriptions to, because they're being filtered out by the algorithms, basically. But mostly, and I think this will chime with a lot of people, the degree of fatigue and exhaustion. People feel, for their own mental health, they want to curtail the amount of news they're paying attention to. What are they doing? Well, there are changes around the world. Newsletters, these are the things, if you've signed up to a news agency and you get a kind of a weekly or a daily feed into your email, they've got fewer stories now, fewer handpicked stories, podcasts that delve into a single subject rather than having a roundup of everything going on, and the reduction in the number of stories that are being filed per day. These are emerged as early winners in the news avoider war. And the other thing is personalization, where basically your email will tailor to what you seem to enjoy when you're browsing the internet and so on. That requires the use of AI, which of course is controversial. But in the BBC, they're saying personalization is going to be a big part of the answer because they have a lot of data, mostly because the BBC require a sign in. It's free content, but you have to sign in and it tailors it to your needs. At the moment, we don't have RT News, which is the biggest news site in Ireland, doesn't have a sign in. That's the kind of crucial part to get the data. And we know that if something is free, that you're the product. But what we want is to trust the companies that are using our data, which is, of course, was misused by Facebook and other companies as well. And they've been fined as such.
So if people are tuning out of the news because it's relentlessly bad and Trumpy, is there any good news to dangle in front of them in a desperate effort to grab their eyeballs, if only just fleetingly? Try this on for size.
A patriotic Irish mum flew soil from her granny's back garden into Britain so that her first baby, her first baby's first steps could technically be on Irish soil. Shauna Bellew is her name, and filled a box with dirt and dipped five weeks old Eliza's feet into it. She's 27. Her fiancé, Sean Tweed, is also 27. And this is a story in the Mirror this morning, the Irish Mirror. When I went back to Ireland to announce I was pregnant in August, I dug up some dirt from granny's garden. On the way back, I was scared security would pull it out. Oh, yeah, of course. And think I was insane. And but she got through it anyway. She put it into a Tupperware, bit of Tupperware, and she dipped the baby's feet. And there's a picture here in the paper and everything. Born in Scotland, but setting foot on Irish soil first. It's kind of, you know, the patriotic symbolism of it all. Speaking of patriotic symbolism, not as fun story. This is the Irish News. Legal threat halting design on the Irish station signs. Oh my God. Design work on Irish language signs on Belfast's Grand Central Station has stopped due to potential legal action. So basically, Belfast is a brand spanking lovely £340 million bus and rail station. But the Irish language signage has been paused due to the threat of legal action. Translink runs the public transport up there in the north. No further work can continue to introduce a signage, no signage can continue until the legal matters are resolved. And there's talk of a judicial review at the moment, and that's all happening at the moment. Sinn Féin has the post of infrastructure minister through Liz Kimmins, and they announced that she had approved the move. And then the DUP said, hold on a second, this should be brought to the Stormont executive for approval. Rule your boolia and a bit of a hubbub, and now it's been stalled. The signage will cost £150,000 in sterling. That's the DUP kind of thing. Oh, it's too expensive and so on. But also, they'll be adding another language to the ticket vending machines. There are five languages already on offer: English, Dutch, German, Italian and Spanish. And they're claiming they will have to remove one of those languages to add Anglaelga, which would cost £28,000 to reconfigure the ticket vending machines. I can't believe that is the cost of just changing the language. To introduce Irish as a language option on the drop-down menu. I mean, like, we can do it down here. Surely it doesn't cost that much, and we're not very much good at doing those kind of projects here. Extraordinary stuff, isn't it? Bogged down in symbolism as usual, unfortunately, in Northern politics, instead of the practical day-to-day business of improving people's lives. That's what they should be doing. Belfast Grand Central Station is the giant signage outside the station. Look at the picture here, and they just have to change it to an Irish language. Wouldn't that help? There are signs of some hope, though, in the DUP, because they have a secret Gaelgor faction. This is also in the Irish News this morning. The DUP leader, Gavin Robinson, has said members of his party and some of its elected representatives are fluent in Irish, but he didn't name who they are. Who could they be, asked the Irish News, and they speculate on a handful of people there. For a party that has effectively opposed every measure that promotes the Irish language, it was a surprise when the DUP leader made the announcement on a radio programme yesterday. The DUP didn't respond to follow-up requests to name names, which the Irish News says is perhaps understandable.
Doch reite. Goodish news. Maybe. Definitely sad news about the death of the Iceman himself, Val Kilmer.
He was only 65 years of age, and of course, big, big star in the 80s and 90s, Top Gun and Batman Forever. He's one of only six men, isn't he, who played Batman in the movie side of things anyway. He was second after Michael Keaton, even though Val Kilmer in a mask. You could tell with Val, with that chin, there was no hiding that this was Bruce Wayne. I'm not sure how Batman got away with it in that Gotham City. Batman Forever was a completely nuts film. It was very camp, but it was a lot of crack. Jim Carrey was the Riddler in that one. Do you remember that one? Yeah, you do. He was sadly diagnosed with throat cancer in 2014. So he did survive 11 years with it, and it was a very serious health struggle. It rendered him completely speechless, and he was out of the public eye for a couple of years. But he's a long legacy of movies behind him. Kind of really well remembered for The Doors in 1991. Then he was in the Western Tombstone. God, I haven't seen that one in a long time. That was brilliant. I did see Heat only a year ago, and it's fantastic. That's the one that put De Niro and Pacino together for the first time. Michael Mann film. Mob and City Hall and all that kind of carry on, but he died from complications caused by pneumonia and of course his wider illness as well, but he did manage, despite his vocal issues, he reprised his role as Tom Cruise is basically his nemesis. He was the Iceman, the pilot Iceman in Top Gun, and came back in Maverick 2022. That was really, was that 3 years ago now? That was a great film. Made his name in comedies, Top Secret in 84 and Real Genius the following year, but it was really Top Gun that brought him up. And he was also in Willow, really. And Batman Forever was 1995, 30 years ago. And it wasn't great. And he pulled out of the next movie, even though he would have made piles of money, basically.
The great Val Kilmer, R.I.P. That's the sad note we're ending our excerpt from this morning's Oliver Callan monologue on. In the words of Gay Perry, as played by Val in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, go, sleep badly. Any questions, hesitate to call. We all worry that we spend too much time peering at our phones. That's why, presumably, one bar and restaurant in Cork has decided to introduce a phone-free evening on one night of the week. And it's not even a Monday night. Today with Clareburn reporter Brian O'Connell was on hand this morning to tell us how the bar, Osho, is getting on since the offline night was introduced.
So every Tuesday from 6:30 to 8:30, you pay €10 then. It includes a drink and you're instructed to lock your phone away. They have a zip bag where it's cable tied shut. You can't get access to it for 2 hours.
Extreme.
They have a range of... Well, I suppose you have to take an extreme measure when we're so welded to them, don't you? They have a range of things to do so besides drinks. So arts and crafts for adults. They have tarot card readings, crosswords. And you could actually chat to people. Imagine that.
Interesting.
It's gone so well, Claire. They're now considering having phone-free lunch days. So Michael Droney is owner of Osho, and he told me where he got the idea of a phone-free night.
Well, I've got a few businesses and I'm on my phone an awful lot. And it was in my mind. And then I spotted the Offline Club in Amsterdam, which is a movement where they get together in cafes, bars, and they give up their phones for 2 or 3 hours. They reignite passion for drawing or art or just chatting, doing the crossword. And, you know, I found myself, when I did one, we did one ourselves, a test one, and I found myself drawing and colouring, and it was just chill. It's nice. You can buy a ticket for a tenner, and that includes a drink and all the materials, the games, Scrabble, Cluedo, Battleship. And then the front of the pub is the drinkers, but they've got a hand in their phones too.
Everybody at the start hands in the phone.
Yep. And we were wondering, should we get lock boxes and take the phones behind the bar? But we said we get the plastic kind of manila zip envelopes and we cable tie them shut. And from talking to people, they prefer keeping the phone with them in the cable tied envelope because there's a less separation anxiety.
So you've had a number of events at this stage. What was it like?
For me, there was an unbelievable sense of calm at the first one. There was a few walk-ins, to be fair, and a few people walked out.
So a few people walked in going to have their pint and you said, by the way, you need to hand, obviously pay for the pint, but you need to give me your phone as well.
Yeah.
Out the door.
Oh, like, you know, one person looked at me as if he wanted to kill me. Another person said, no way, you know, I'm expecting a phone call. How am I going to pay? Which is very understandable. I'm very protective of my own phone. But it's funny to see people's reactions after about 10 or 15 minutes of being a bit awkward. People were chatting and having a crack. And yeah, it was lovely.
So Tuesday night at the moment, is there a plan to expand it?
We're reopening for lunch. The pubs have kind of come out of their pandemic hangover and there's people back to work. So we're planning on doing lunchtime, no phones, 5 days a week.
It does sound like a great idea when you hear Michael explain how it works, but it might sound a bit ambitious thinking about phone-free lunches, Brian.
I suppose it depends who you go to lunch with. Like, it could be a very long lunch, couldn't it?
Could be.
if you can't have the phone for a bit of distraction. Interesting, as he said, some people walked in on Tuesday night and walked out again when they were told they couldn't use the phone. And then, as you said, the lunchtime. Yeah, I mean, I think it's quite an interesting proposal. There is a bar actually in Cork called the High B. It's a famous bar where chewing gum and mobile phones were not allowed by the owner, Brian O'Donnell, many years ago. He passed away in 2019, but both of them, I'm told, are still banned. Kneecap actually gave the bar a shout out recently. So there is a bit of precedence here in Cork. One of those who was at the phone-free night in the bar in Cork was Ailish McKenzie Foley. She's marketing and events manager. So obviously she's on her phone a lot, as you can imagine. And I was curious to know how she got on. I asked her, Claire, on a scale of 1 to 10, what were the withdrawal symptoms like being in the bar without her phone?
Oh, solid 10. Solid 10 across the board.
Did you have that physical thing where you were reaching for it constantly?
Yes, and Michael was there and he can verify that. No, my phone went into the regular bag and then they put it into another one because they caught me trying to check the time. It was a very weird experience because it's my livelihood. I use my phone, my laptop, I'm on it at work and then I go home and I use it to unwind. And So being in there at the start was really difficult because I kept reaching for it or I wanted to see what was going on. And then after a while, I kind of got used to not having to pick it up. Or, you know, when there's a lag in conversation with someone, your first instinct is, oh, let me check my phone really quickly because I feel awkward. But instead, I let my phone to the side and I actually got to talk with some lovely people I've never met before and who I never would have interacted with if I didn't have my phone.
Chance physical encounters as opposed to random digital encounters, which we seem to be having more of. Yeah,
exactly. And I think it's really important because it's something that's so common to be on your phone. It's so unnatural because you walk around anywhere, people are on their phone. You're on the train, they're on their phone. On the bus, even walking, you see people on FaceTime and video, and there's nothing wrong with that, but we never have a chance to disconnect.
How did it change the atmosphere in the bar?
I honestly think it was so much livelier and friendlier.
More conversation.
So much more conversation.
Mm. All right, and that's what you want, I suppose. And yeah. You talked to some students then, Brian, about whether this would appeal to them. But we know the studies that tell us that we are checking our phones an awful lot, aren't we?
Listen, I looked at a study from 2022 by Deloitte and I had to stop reading it at a certain point because it was almost leading to a process of self-examination, as you can imagine, around smartphone use. A third of people check their mobile phones at least 50 times a day. Two-thirds admit to using their phones as soon as they wake up, and more than half of Irish adults wish they spent less time on their devices. So I suppose the studies are quite clear. We're using our phones perhaps too much and we're finding it hard to strike a balance. Earlier this week, I actually spent time with first-year journalism students in UL, and they're obviously very active social media users, as you can imagine. I thought I'd take the opportunity to, Claire, just to ask some of them, how would they feel about a phone-free night in their local bar? And this is some of what they told me.
It's a very good idea, and I think lots of times when you go to the pub or you go out with your friends, a lot of it is centred around like just sitting there on your phones. So to ban that completely will just make conversation so much easier with your friends or other people.
And do you have a kind of an unwritten rule with your friends when you're out socially? Do you say, now we're not going to touch the phones for the next half hour?
We try to, but sure, then you get a notification and you get a bit distracted or whatever. Like, you just can't police it, to be honest.
It's kind of a sad indictment of society that we're having to take away phones from people who are going out for a bite to eat.
It is, yeah, it is, to be honest. And you can kind of tell it's harder to have actual meaningful conversations in real life.
What do you make of going for a bite to eat without the phone?
I'd definitely try it. When you put away the phones, that's when conversations start happening. And often the best chats and things you have, you realise you're 3 or 4 hours in and you haven't touched your phone in that time, you know.
And what about this business of people going, when they go to a restaurant, have something to eat, the first thing they have to do is take a picture of the food?
It's all about, you know, making your life seem better than everyone else's. You know, you're at this concert, you're having this meal at this restaurant, you have to show everyone else that your life is as good as them, because that's what they're doing as well, you know.
It's quite artificial.
100%.
Would you avail of a place if they said, look, hand the phone into the front desk there and you can sit down and have your food?
I'd try.
Going to the pub without your phone, what would you think of that?
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. I'm
have
all
you
for
ever
it.
Done it?
I have not. No, I definitely like to do it just to you know, have proper conversations with the people you're there and maybe even meet other people.
That's interesting. You say proper conversations, because do you feel like sometimes people are not fully present?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think conversations without a phone are more meaningful.
Sorry, I didn't catch that. I just had to check out a message from the Radio Catch-Up Show presenters' WhatsApp group. Yeah, it could have waited, to be honest. Journalism students in University of Limerick there giving Brian O'Connell their opinions on phone usage in bars and restaurants on Today with Claire Byrne this morning. Caller Anne spoke to Joe Duffy on this afternoon's Liveline about an ad for women's shaving products that she has problems with.
I don't like it, Joe, because I think it's a step too far. It cheapens females. It's not tasteful, and it does have a sexual connotation. While females shave, they shave under their arms as well as their private parts. Why not just contain the ad to maybe under the arms? Personally, Joe, I wouldn't buy that product for that reason, because I don't like the way it's made.
Or the way it's advertised.
Yes, the way the advertisement is made, yeah.
So you say if they'd stuck to the shaving your armpits...
Well, at least they could do that. But, I mean, you're going down. I mean, I'll tell you, Joe, why around. Because last night I was watching, of course, TV, and it had a different slant. It put the camera at an angle where it was at the top of the lady's underwear and it was showing the pubic hair. I mean, there's no need for this. There is no need for this. No.
And then is it fair to say that the whole concentration of the ad is down there, so to speak?
Well, it seems to be down there. Yes, it does. And I mean, to me, it just cheapens women. It's a step too far. And I think in society today, women need to be respected. And everything has a knock-on effect and everything else. And women are not, in certain areas, being respected. They're being raped, murdered, beaten up, as we all know. Society's not becoming any better. It's becoming worse. And we all have our part to play.
How can a Procter & Gamble ad about a Venus razor... that the ad focuses on the uses around the bikini line and pubic hair. Mm. How can that be regarded as contributing to the demeaning of women?
I'm only giving my opinion, and I have spoken to my friends and colleagues, and they don't like it either, Joe. But I think we have all in society become complacent. We're saying, we don't like it, but are we going to do anything about it?
Well, you're not going to have any luck with Procter & Gamble. This is one of the biggest companies. This is one of the biggest companies in the world. They're worth their turnover of 100 billion. Mm.
Yeah.
Probably their turnover is probably greater. Well, by 10 o'clock this evening, probably greater than the GDP of Ireland. And they have, of their 100 billion they've sent us in, they've managed to spare €4 out of 100 billion turnover to send us in a 3-line statement saying... we're brilliant. Our advert explains its benefits to women in what we believe is an accurate and respectful manner.
It's not, Joe. I want other females out there.
Well, I wish someone from Procter Gamble would come on at least. After 100 billion companies. So we could ask them, what are the benefits to women they are explaining? Do you know? Can you help me here?
Joe. We know how to shave, let's face it, us ladies. But if you have a male on an ad, the man is depicted, oh, he's handsome and, you know, and all the rest of it. There's nothing, no private parts there. But with ladies, it's all sex sells. And it is disrespectful. And I am not going to change my mind.
Well, neither are Procter or Gamble, they say. You see, we'll try and find other words that might... The Procter & Gamble retort to your response, their retort is, our advert explains its benefits. Now, in the advert, does it actually say, these are the benefits, health or otherwise, of shaving your bikini line?
But, I mean, the benefits, we don't need them to make an ad to tell us the benefits, Joe. I mean, there's plenty of items out there like that. You know, don't do that. And they're the items I would buy, my friends would buy.
But
the
they
benefits,
don't.
We don't need to be shown the benefits, you know.
But Procter & Gamble, I know they were two English men 200 years ago, went chemists who went to the UK, and it's an extraordinarily successful company, 100 billion, as I say, turnover. But the ad, as I saw the ad, it didn't say these are the benefits or this will help you live a better life. Or I can understand other ads where, especially female hygiene products, which should be advertised and are advertised widely, and they have obviously benefits on a number of levels for women. But the advert doesn't explain how using this Venus razor around your bikini line, and you say beyond the ad, the advert implies beyond, doesn't it? They don't explain the benefits. They don't say, you know, when you see the ad for Colgate, which is our program, they say, you know, 57 out of 62 dentists use Colgate or Sensodyne or whatever. If you don't wash your hair on a regular basis, you will become unhygienic or whatever. They don't say if you don't shave down there, it's not unhygienic, is it?
Yeah.
There's no damage
caused. They don't say anything. They're just...
Well, okay, let me put it differently. Sorry, I'm trying to help people. Is that your exasperation or my exasperation? What are the negatives of not shaving down there? What are the disbenefits or unbenefits or non-benefits of not taking the razor on that journey?
I mean, that's really not what the ad is about. I mean,
now, that's what I mean.
Not shaving or shaving,
I'm not asking you. Sorry, it sounds like I am. I'm asking this mysterious company that's worth 100 billion, Procter & Gamble, who can't supply a spokesperson, to say what...
Yeah.
If you say the ad explains the benefits, well, then if a woman doesn't do this, what are the non-benefits? What's the downside of not shaving down there? Is it about body positivity, Anne? Feeling good about yourself?
No, it's not. It's basically about them selling their product, and they think if they have a kind of a sexual slant or connotation to it, that, you know, sex sells, and that's what that's about. It's not about...
Yeah, but the product is a female product primarily, isn't it? Like, men buy... The razor wouldn't be strong enough for a man's hair growth.
Yeah.
So it's not aimed at men. So, Procter & Gamble, the $100 billion company, say 80%, this is obviously a survey they did, 80% of women in Ireland regularly remove their pubic hair. 90% of those women, of the 80%, if you follow me, 90% of the 80% don't feel that it should be ashamed to do so. So why would you ask them? It's a stupid question. Of course they shouldn't be ashamed of doing anything to their own bodies, regardless of the location.
But it's private, Joe. We don't remove our pubic hair on television or out on the street. We do it privately. And the ad should be in line with that. They can do it differently. To make the ad, certainly. But make it differently.
Now you said
do it nice and tasteful and I'll buy it.
Me too. That's caller Anne talking to Joe Duffy on this afternoon's Liveline about an ad for women's shaving products she feels is unnecessarily graphic. Multi-award-winning journalist Carol Cadwallader is best known for breaking the Cambridge Analytica Facebook story, and she's going to be in Ireland for the Granard Booktown Festival, which takes place from the 11th to the 13th of April. Carol joined Oliver Callan on the line this morning.
The big one is 2018, the huge scoop on the stolen data and how it was used in the US election and elsewhere. Extraordinary story. What is the point for you, Carol, when you realise that you have the expose of a lifetime in your hands?
I mean, it was really early on in that it felt like such an enormous story, because at the time, Steve Bannon, you know, he was the chief advisor to Donald Trump, the president. Mm-hmm. And Steve Bannon had been the vice president of this firm. And I was talking to this whistleblower who'd worked inside the firm. This, if you remember him, this sort of pink-haired guy, Christopher Wiley.
Yeah.
And he, you know, he had the receipts. So he had, you know, he'd worked directly with Chris with Steve Bannon, and he you know, I'd heard these rumors about how the company had acquired this massive amount of Facebook data, you know, illicitly through a psychological, a personality quiz. And this guy, you know, had the receipts for that. He literally had the receipts. And it felt very precarious right from the off, because we were just dealing with these, you know, very powerful, very dangerous people. And it, you know, it spanned, it wasn't, you know, so it was these very, you know, obviously these very powerful people in America. It was also these very powerful people in Britain. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, that there was also the Brexit campaign, the Nigel Farage, you know, crew had talked openly about using this company. And there was sort of half the British establishment on this board as well. So it felt really, I knew that I had a really big story from the off. And, you know, I initially published parts of the story using Chris as an anonymous source,
right?
And those did go incredibly viral. It was, you know, people were really shocked, I think, because it was sort of showing these links between Trump and between Brexit and also to Russia. That was the sort of third sort of point of it, and it showed that sort of, you know, the thing which was the weapon here was data. Mm-hmm. It was people's personal data, and it was, you know, information. And so it did feel that I'd sort of stumbled on this sort of, you know, secret world of propaganda and power and influence. And, you know, I always knew it was going to be a hornet's nest, and that's why it took a really long time, actually, to be able to bring him out. And
yeah. You spoke to him for a year, is that right, before you...
Exactly. And then, you know, and it kind of went on for years after that.
Well, the ramifications were extraordinary, not just obviously devastating to Cambridge Analytica, which is destroyed, but you probably didn't expect the fallout to impact Facebook so severely.
That's right. I mean, I always sort of refer to it. We knew exactly that it was going to be sort of devastating to Cambridge Analytica, and not least because we'd worked with Channel 4. They did this undercover reporting in which, you know, that you could see, there were sort of extraordinary bits in it where the CEO, Alexander Nix, was, you know, talking about the work that they did in foreign countries and how they would even, you know, they would seek to flying girls, he talked about, to, you know, to bribe politicians. I mean, it was sort of amazing, least sort of shady sort of behavior that's now been exposed. But the violation of people's privacy and their data, we never really hadn't expected. I mean, Facebook, I would sort of say, blew themselves up on our doorstep. They mishandled it so badly. You know, they went quiet for 3 days, and then finally Mark Zuckerberg stepped out and said that he was sorry. And it was this, you know, it was these gross violations that really serious offences that we discovered afterwards. So Facebook got fined $5 billion as a result of the Cambridge Analytica scandal by the FTC. That was a record. And $100 million by the SEC in America. And, the amazing thing about it is the ramifications from it are still... absolutely still rolling on. So Mark Zuckerberg was actually deposed 2 weeks ago. He had to give evidence to attorneys for hours over what he knew when about Cambridge Analytica.
Wow.
Because there are still lawsuits rolling on, because there's still been this key question about they failed to tell shareholders that there had been this data breach. They failed to tell users. So it's that classic thing they sort of say, it's not the crime, it's the cover up, and that is still playing out to this day.
In fact, they essentially changed the name. They rebranded as Meta as a result of, of this entire...
I refuse. Actually, I have to say is that people do now refer to it as Meta, and I'm just like, it's still Facebook.
They
tried to wipe the stink of the scandal off, but it's still there.
Because it was so badly damaged, not least in Ireland, where it's regulated on behalf of the European Union. It's been fined $2.5 billion in the space of 1 2-year period for various data and privacy breaches by our regulator here.
What's its reputation in Ireland now? I mean,
a celebrated company, never criticised by any government official I can find, but a celebrated company because of the number of jobs in Ireland. Obviously, we're a centre of tech. That's one of the reasons it's kind of well looked after. It's comfortable in Ireland. But I suppose the question is, Facebook has become really powerful, more so even since then, in terms of its valuation, its stock price and so on. In fact, I think even the $5 billion fine resulted in its share price going up that day because the business model was not affected. And that's the crucial point.
That's right. That's right. I mean, the whole kind of experience of it, to me, you know, led to this understanding that we essentially live in this age of zero accountability. And we live in an age when, you know, we have a very romantic idea of journalism still. We still think of Watergate, you know, the idea that journalism could topple a president. That we do, you know, that world does not exist anymore. And essentially these companies operate with total impunity for the reasons that you just mentioned. And nobody has, you know, was ever held to account for it. I mean, you know, Facebook, you know, we know has done worse than that. You know, we know that the United Nations, you know, refers to them having an instrumental role in the genocide in Myanmar. There's never been any consequences to that either. And so it's this impunity, really, of these companies that is why we are now. I mean, what's so clear now is that Silicon Valley is part of the Trump regime. And I think we do have to call it a regime. That is what we are seeing. Mm. And, you know, this merger between Silicon Valley and this, you know, would-be autocrat is a sort of wholly new type of power in the world. And, you know, I've been calling it broligarchy because it's not just oligarchy. It's the tech bros version of it. And, you know, I think if you look at what Elon Musk is doing, he's not looking to profit from the government per se. I mean, that's just part of it. He's looking to replace government. I mean, that's what it's this technocratic urge to replace the federal workers with large language models, which, of course, he controls.
Of course. Journalist Carol Cadwallader talking to Oliver Callan this morning. Carol will be appearing at the Granard Booktown Festival, which is on from the 11th to the 13th of this month. As mentioned earlier on this edition of Playback Daily, it was announced overnight that the actor Val Kilmer has died. The Today with Claire Byrne team put together a little collage of Val in various roles. See if you can name every film here.
I'm your huckleberry.
So early. You guys want to get some coffee or something?
You're everyone's problem. That's because every time you go up in the air, you're unsafe. I don't like you because you're dangerous.
The bat signal is not a beeper.
One bullet, didn't I?
You put a live round in that gun.
Oh, yeah. There was like an 8% chance.
8%?
Wasn't it just 8?
8?
Yeah.
Who taught you math?
Does this mean we're not friends anymore? You know, Ed, if I thought you were my friend, I just don't think I could bear it.
Did you get them all? Of course you did. Claire spoke to the film critic and host of the Bellissimo Files podcast, Serena Bellissimo, this morning about the actor and his brilliantly varied career.
We all know that back in 2014, he was actually diagnosed with throat cancer, but he actually recovered from that. He did, as a result of his throat surgery, did have problems with his voice after that. Mm-hmm. But He seemed to be doing fine. And then, as we said, we heard yesterday, he was only 65, Claire, but what an amazing career he had. Like, I was on IMDb to have a look at his credits and I thought, oh, yeah, maybe he's done about 50, 60 movies. He had 104 credits to his name.
You know, yeah. Myself, when I was looking into his background this morning, I wasn't really aware of Val Kilmer's pedigree in terms of his training and his theatre background. He was a very accomplished performer.
He really was. Like, you know, he broke onto the scene in 1984 in like this parody, like spoof films were huge in the 80s. And that's where he got his start. And then we all got to know him because of Top Gun. So I suppose we all thought he was this movie star, which he was, but he loved the theatre. And, you know, it wasn't just, you know, I think theatre, you think maybe some musicals and stuff. He did Shakespeare. He was in New York. He also, now I have to admit, I didn't know this until today. He also published a book of poetry called My Edens After Burns. And some of it was inspired from his relationship with a really, when they were young, with Michelle Pfeiffer.
Oh.
So I didn't know that. He was more than just acting.
Well, tell us a little bit about his most memorable roles. I mean, you spoke about just how many movies he starred in, but the ones that really stand out that will form part of his legacy in your view.
Well, I think for me, it's top, like everyone has something with Val Kilmer. Like when I say Val Kilmer, what's your first movie that comes to your mind?
Probably Top Gun, I would say.
Yeah, yeah. And see, I think that's mine as well. I mean, it's the one, Ice. No one played a villain like he did with Iceman in Top Gun. And when they remade Top Gun Maverick, which was the final film we saw him in, it was that scene that came to my mind this morning. It was the emotional scene. It was the reunion on screen between Tom Cruise and Val Kilmer. And I say their names because when you're watching that scene, you felt like it was the two of them saying goodbye to, not to each other, but to that character, to that legacy that they had created. And you could tell that Val Kilmer wasn't in his prime, but it was one of the most emotional scenes mm-hmm. I had seen. So I think it was Top Gun. The other one that came to my mind was Batman Forever. I mean, he's done so much more. But, yeah, he was in Batman Forever.
What I noted this morning when I was looking back is that he didn't want to revisit that role despite how successful he was in it.
Exactly. And I mean, he just replaced Michael Keaton and it was a great cast as well. Chris O'Donnell was his Robin, but there was like Nicole Kidman, Tommy Lee Jones, Jim Carrey, Drew Barrymore. But he was like, no, that was it. He said he'd felt uncomfortable with the role and he didn't want to play anymore. I don't know if that had to do as well with the fact that he didn't get along with director Joel Schumacher. Joel Schumacher said that his leading man behaviour was difficult and childish, and he did have that, like a lot of people did say he was difficult to work with. In 1996, he worked on The Island of Dr. Moreau with, and this is what we forget as well, he worked with some legends. He worked with Marlon Brando on this film. It wasn't a great film. It was a flop. But the reason I also talk about this is the director on that film, John Frankenheimer, said he would never, ever work with Kilmer again because it was really difficult. He said, I don't like Val Kilmer. I don't like his work ethic and I don't want to be associated with him ever again. But I love what Val said. He responded and said, when certain people criticize me for being demanding, I think that's a cover for something they didn't do well. I think they're trying to protect themselves. I believe I'm challenging, not demanding, and I make no apologies for that. Mm-hmm. And I think because he was challenging in that he knew what he wanted to do with the character. And so he brought characters to life. I mean, Jim Morrison in The Doors, he was incredible. Even Jim's bandmates from The Doors, I mean, Val recorded the music. Sometimes they couldn't tell the difference in what Val was singing and what Jim was singing. He was incredible.
Mm-hmm. And we know that Oliver Stone called him Jim on the set of Doors because Val was intensely committed to that role.
A brief tribute to the late, great Val Kilmer on Today with Claire Byrne this morning with film critic Serena Bellissimo, host of the Bellissimo Files podcast. I guess they had no time to mention Heat, Tombstone or True Romance there, huh? Oh well. Apparently inspired by an ad for Kerrygold, The one where the guy is moving to Germany with his pregnant wife. You know the one. Shauna Bellew, who's from Ireland but lives in Scotland, decided that her newborn baby Eliza would take her first steps on Irish soil, as she explained to Ray Darcy this afternoon.
So my nana is originally from Scotland, but I was born and raised in Navan.
Right.
We moved here to Scotland literally weeks before lockdown. So we're here just over 5 years. So that's where the story originated. Literally, the Kerrygold ad has just been in my mind since it came out. I kind of knew deep down that maybe I'd move abroad with everything going on in Ireland with the housing crisis. So it always stuck with me that I wanted that bit of the ad with me. And when we went home to arrange like a little baby shower slash engagement party, my friend gave me a jar that said Irish soil on it. And I was like, oh, you remembered. So shout out to Chloe for that. And I went to my nana's garden, filled it up with soil, and then made that TikTok that went viral.
Yeah. And is your partner from Ireland as well?
Yeah, he's from Navan. He was my next door neighbour back home.
Was he? And were you always friends?
Well, I lived in Swords for a little while and then I moved back to Navan. So we were neighbours from when I was about 16. So, yeah.
Right. When did it happen? What was the moment?
Which moment?
Yeah, no, when you went from being neighbours to being more than neighbours.
It was just that I had friends over having drinks and they said, oh, do you know Sean lives next door? And I was like, yeah. So I texted him asking if he wanted to have a drink with us. And he said, no, he politely declined, but said, I'll make you a cup of tea in the morning with your hangover. And to be fair to him, he did.
And that was it.
And the rest is history.
That's a lovely story. Yeah. It's little things, isn't it? The cup of tea the morning
and
after.
And now look at us.
Now look at us with a little Eliza. So 2009, which is, by my calculations, 16 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
What age were you when you first saw that ad then?
2009, I would have been 11.
Right. And it made an impression on you.
Yeah, Shauna, and even when I'm showing family now, they're like, God, I love that ad. But I think it's because I have Scottish roots. I was like, why did my nana not do that? And why? So it just always stuck with me.
Yeah. Okay, so you came home and told everyone that you're having a baby and that you're getting you're getting married. When's the wedding?
Oh, we haven't yet. That literally, I found out I was pregnant, and then a couple of days later, Sean had already planned to propose. So it was a whirlwind that weekend.
All right, lot going on there.
So that's on the back burner.
Yeah. So you're home then, and loads of excitement, and well done.
It was a double celebration.
Yeah. And well done, Chloe, on remembering that.
I know. Yeah. That's what she's saying. I can't believe my jar caused all this.
So you went out to Nan's back garden
and
you filled it with soil.
Yeah. And then we flew the soil home. Was a bit terrified that I'd be stopped being like, what have you brought on your flight? But
is there any legislation around that? I don't know if you're...
See, I was Googling it just to make sure, but obviously there's not really a legislation on soil, so I just chanced it.
Right. I'm just thinking, because if everybody did it...
We do like the ferry home here and there. So.
if everybody did it, Shauna.
You know, that's it. Yeah. That's what I'm saying, there's a business venture there if anyone wants to sell soil.
It's funny because I was down recording the little promo we do for the show today, and Jake, who works in the studio down there, is from Scotland. And he heard me say that we're going to be hearing the story about the little girl who walked on Irish soil in Scotland. And he said, would you tell that woman that actually we used to be connected, as in Scotland and Ireland used to be connected back in the day. So it's the same soil. That's what he wanted to do. So there you go. So you had Eliza and you have the jar. Where did you keep the jar?
So the jar was given to me and then I filled it and I literally just kept it in a press. And the funny thing is, it was when she was born, we took it out and left it on the coffee table and kept saying, right, we need to do this before she has a bath. And every time we'd give her the bath, we'd be like, oh, we forgot. So it was sitting there for weeks. And then finally, I was like, right, let's do this. I want to get a little video to show her when she's older. And we just did it. If I'd have known it would go as viral, I would have done it a week ago.
And you would have done a better job. No, it's a lovely video. And I love the fact that it's just that final bit of that ad, the final 8 seconds or so, the thing that I repeated there. And her little feet, of course, she can't walk on it because she's only...
No.
How old is she?
Should be 5 weeks tomorrow.
Right, okay, yeah, yeah. So you just hold her above it. And,
yeah.
And what was the reaction? Because that's a very tactile thing, you know, bare
yeah,
little feet.
Yeah, little feet were squirming in
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I love it. I love the fact that you said press as well, because they don't say press over there, do
no,
they?
No, they don't. No, there's they so don't. Many words they don't say over here.
Yeah, yeah, I love that. So you haven't lost that. No. What a brilliant... So what's the reaction been? Because I think it's 4 million or over 4
yeah.
million views.
Like, I did say to my fiancé, Sean, when I put it up, I was like, I think this might break through to Ireland. Obviously, we're on the UK side of TikTok. I was like, if it gets through to Ireland, we might get a couple of thousand views. Like, I think it'll be a bit nostalgic for people. So I could not believe when it just... grew legs and so yeah, the reaction was lovely. A lot of Irish people abroad saying that they wish they'd done it or they're keeping this in mind. Obviously the Australian people yeah. that have moved in, there's no way we're getting soil over here, but a couple of bad comments say I think they think that I don't want her to be Scottish, so they were taking
oh,
it the
I
wrong
see.
Way
yes yes
so there
yes.
was comments being like, but she's Scottish though, and yes. I was trying to be like, I know, I'm not saying she's not. I just wanted her to have a bit of her Irish roots with her. Like, it's not that serious. It's a butter ad. It's
yes, yes. And she can be both. She can enjoy being
exactly,
Scottish and
yeah.
Irish, except when there's rugby or football on or whatever.
Yeah, no, that's 100%.
Yeah. Oh, we've got a call from the Department of Foreign Affairs. Seemingly it's illegal. They want their soil back.
Stop.
Scotland-dwelling Shauna Bellew there, being joshed by Ray Darcy over her decision to copy a Kerrygold ad and make sure that the soil her daughter took her first steps on was Irish. Fair play. Finally, on this edition of Playback Daily, some people don't just want to go and visit new places and enjoy the food and the drink and the culture. They want to be inspired by their surroundings to sing as if no one was listening. That's where Ed Finn from Ed Finn Travels comes in, as he told Claire Byrne this morning.
So the Sound of Music, imagine, celebrating 60th anniversary this year. Hugely popular, of course, amazing. And Salzburg is, I mean, the city of music anyway, because, you know, the home place of Mozart, etc. But yeah, I did this panorama Sound of Music bus tour, and I was with, there was 20 Americans from Tennessee. There was people from all over the world on it. And
listen,
unashamedly singing all the songs.
See, some people would love that, Ed.
Yeah.
And some people, it's their worst nightmare.
I know. But I wasn't sure what I would react with, but I actually loved it. I embraced it. But it was brilliant because I did the walking tour around, a fabulous guy did us this smiling tours of Salzburg. Really interesting history there. And, you know, he brought me to the Abbey, the Nonnberg Abbey, where Maria was a nun. So you have the...
Yes,
you know,
I remember it from the movie. It was a white concrete building.
Yeah,
isn't it? Yeah,
that's beautiful. And, I mean, the nuns actually have removed the bell from the front of the door because they don't want anyone ringing the bell anymore because it's so famous now. But we went in and it was me and the guide inside in the church in the Abbey, and the nuns were singing up in the cloister kind of area, and it was so amazing. I thought
Incredible.
It was just orchestrated.
But
beautiful.
On the bus, when you're moving on the bus,
yeah.
are people singing the songs
yes.
The Sound of Music?
Yeah.
And was that okay with you, Ed?
Lewis, our tour guide, who's originally from Costa Rica, by the way, he was fabulous. He has lived there for years. But yeah, it was great because everywhere we went, right, we were singing different songs. And you stop off, you go to the gazebo, you know, where Ralph, you know, where I am 16 going on 17.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Yeah, and you go to all the palaces, the house where they fell into the water.
Yeah.
They tell you all the history, like how, you know, they kept doing it over and over again. Julie Andrews was going mental because she kept getting soaked. But anyway, you get all these facts of stuff. And then the whole history of the family. I mean, Robert Wise, the director, where he actually, the actual place in the cemetery, St. Peter's, where they were running away from the Nazis that time, from the Germans, he actually recreated that in Hollywood. And, you know, you get the whole history of when they left, mm-hmm. of course. And, you know, the granddaughter of Johannes, the only child of Maria's that was born in America, she was over recently giving a chat.
So if you were to go on that tour, you'd have to throw yourself into it, right?
You would.
Have to buy into
Absolutely.
It. And you're like, I'm going to sing
yeah.
at the top of my voice on that bus. I'm going to be the best
yeah.
singer.
And, listen,
and you love it.
Yeah, you love it. And it's brilliant. And you go to the place, you know, in the movie, where the beautiful town where the church where they got married, you know, that's not where they actually got have married, but you know, Euler. But it's stunning. But like, yeah, it is the best thing. To away all the antidepressants, Claire, this is going to lift your spirits.
Lift your spirits. Yeah. Well, listen, we're talking about this because of, you know, you're going on holiday, you're a music lover. What better way to connect and to relax than to visit these places and have the authentic experience?
And it breaks down all these barriers, you know, because everyone is chatting. Like, you're chatting to people from Brazil, Japan, Argentina, and they're all singing the song, right? Mm. So you're wondering, but brilliant. And of course, the other thing I did, you know, the Mozart, of course, then, you know, amazing there. Everywhere you go, there's concerts on and stuff. I went to this beautiful dinner concert. So you go into this beautiful room.
Now tell people where you were when this happened.
In Salzburg.
Right,
yeah.
Salzburg,
so
again.
Peter, so it's called St. Peter's. It's the oldest restaurant in Salzburg, right? So it's like a little mini palace. And you go in and there's all these tables and you sit down, and then they, Fernando and the other lady, they come in and they sing all this lovely opera to you.
Beautiful.
While you're having a rather sumptuous meal.
Gorgeous.
But it was like something you'd really, I loved it. It was great. Yeah, really enjoyable.
Okay, now you went to Bonn as well, the birthplace of Beethoven.
Now, Bonn, I mean, funny thing, Bonn is a place I'd never really thought, you know, I was on my list.
It wouldn't be really, I don't think, for many
people. So, of course, the birthplace of Beethoven. And how I found it was I was doing a cruise from Frankfurt up to Andernach at 3 nights.
You see, this is his life now, everybody else.
Claire, I have to say now, right? I thought river cruising was for a certain age. It is for everybody. I mean, there was people from all ages. It only takes, it's MS Grace was the name of the ship, part of the Scylla line. But it was so nice. You know, you have all your meals. You're in a beautiful room with the sliding doors and you're sailing along Boppard, Bad Salzig, Koblenz, Bonn anyway, right? We stopped. So, of course, Beethoven is celebrating again. It was his 275th anniversary recently or whatever. But the house where he was born, so many people there. You just see all over the world, a whole museum there. And then we were brought in and they do a concert for you. This fantastic Japanese pianist, Takehiro Sakamoto. I pronounced that wrong. He's very famous over there. And then he played some of Mozart's symphonies and Moonlight Sonata and stuff. And it's just magic.
Beautiful.
Really nice, yeah.
And then back on the cruiser and stuff the face again.
Bonn is lovely because you know the way Bonn was the former capital, of course, of Germany, so up to 1990. Mm-hmm. So I did the Path to Democracy tour. But think again, lovely cobble streets, great cafe society. A bit of a real surprise for me, Bonn. I loved it.
Yeah, you went to the equivalent of the Oris there as well, I believe.
Yeah, they have, it's beautiful. And it's open to the public. You can go every month and visit it. Beautiful, gorgeous artwork and stuff.
And there's festivals happening there this year.
This summer, again, fabulous place. Lovely. And if you want to go and stay there as well, loads of lovely hotels there. Very good value. Very nice. Bonn was the kind of place I thought to myself, you know, I can actually live here, no problem. You know that sort of feeling when you get in a place, very civilised.
Again, somewhere
on the river.
Probably not on the list, but then, you know, well
worth
it.
Definitely. And if you do that, if you like to try a little river cruise, really a great way to see all these places.
Cruising is on my list. Going on a cruise is on my list.
No, it's brilliant. And there's a cruise for everyone, Claire, right? Just make sure you book the right one.
Leipzig. You love Leipzig as well.
Yeah, now Leipzig's amazing because, again, and this is a place that's interesting because the home of Bach, of course, he lived here for 27 years and they're having a huge, it's again his 275th birthday in 25. Amazing place. It's another city of music. It's only an hour and 20 minutes by train from Berlin, by the way, because we don't have direct flights there. So a really beautiful place. But think about, again, that sort of gorgeous German cafes, cobble streets. But back, the festivals this year are incredible. And I know people that went there last year and they were raving about it, as in, you know, why haven't I gone here before? So Leipzig, another really beautiful city for music.
Ed Finn from his eponymous travel company, talking to Claire Byrne this morning about cities for music lovers. And that's all I have for you on this regular Wednesday edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Sheridan. Don't forget, you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio app. And the mothership, that'd be Playback, is on air and in podcast land every Saturday when Sinead Mooney has an able to leap tall buildings in a single bound look back at an entire week in radio. For me though, until tomorrow, thank you for listening, and hey, good luck to us all.